There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Now we're going to look at the UAE's fast-growing trade ties to Africa, from flying to food to finance. Delighted to be joined in the studio by the Emirati writer Michel Al-Ghagawi, who's one of the founders of the Washington-based think tank Emerge 85. Michel, good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Emerge 85, a think tank based in the UAE and also in Washington, D.C. in the United States, has produced a number of reports recently, one of them on Africa. And you say that Africa is still rising. There's been a bit of a wobble because commodity prices have fallen over the past 3 years or so, but the story is still fundamentally intact, and the UAE is at the forefront of that story. Tell us more.
So fundamentally, if you think about the growth that we've seen in the 85 world, which we consider basically the non-West, so 85% of the world population lives outside of North America and Western Europe. Most of that growth has been driven by China and, to an extent, India. So the sort of emerging market story is fundamentally an Asian story. And I think that's been the case in the last 25 or 30 years. But I think Africa is going to play a larger and larger role as their polities get organized, as their economies scale, as they get more integration in their economies together. And I think the UAE has been able to position itself in a very interesting position. And that is, you fundamentally have two different ideas of how to participate in Africa. You have the Western way, which is what we've seen in the 80s, and it's aid-driven. And then you have the Chinese way, which is infrastructure investments in return for resources. The UAE has done things a little bit differently. So it's diversified from food security to telecommunication to infrastructure to a whole host of things. And I think the advantage that the UAE has is it's a small country, and it's a country that's reconciled with the global order and rules and norms. And so when a small country like the UAE, with really good infrastructure systems and that's globally connected, comes to an African country, that's a lot less scary than a country as big as China, and a lot more effective than, I don't know, USAID or something like that.
I was staggered, and you quote research from FDI, part of the Financial Times, that shows that last year, foreign direct investment flows into Africa, China was number one. That's no surprise. We know China has a big Africa strategy. Number two was the UAE with $11 billion. I was staggered to read that. Where's that $11 billion going, Michel?
So think about it. Etisalat is in 14 countries. It's serving 70 million people. Dubai Ports is in a number of ports. At the very least, it operates 8 marine terminals in 5 countries. And then you have Emirates Airlines in 25 countries. And then you have a lot of foreign aid that's going into Somalia primarily, but a whole host of other places. It's just that the UAE's drive, whether it's economically driven by Dubai or politically driven by Abu Dhabi's aid policy, just gets us there all the time.
I guess one of the big questions, I mean, China, you know, the money they put in, they're getting something back. They're taking resources out of the country. Right across Africa, they're buying up this, that, and the other. For the UAE, what percentage of that figure that Richard mentioned there is down to aid, and how much is investment that we're getting something back from?
I don't have the specific breakdown, but my understanding is that aid is a smaller part, and primarily it's investments, because most of the examples I mentioned are corporations, with the exception of the aid to Somalia. So I would say that for the UAE, the return is not necessarily extraction of resources compared to China, but a lot of it is trade links, re-exports. Today, you walk into Dubai Mall and you see African families. You don't just see the African kind of middle-aged man coming in for a conference. His whole family's here. Today, Africans are acting just like Indians and Iranians and Russians, buying apartments here as their second homes. It has become a hub for Africa, which is something we find very odd, considering that you have some very interesting hubs within Africa, like Nairobi.
Well, our own producer this morning is sitting behind you. Esther Kabugi is there. She, of course, waving. Is typical of the new breed of Africans that we see in sort of everyday jobs here in this region?
Well, I mean, Africans are not different from anybody else from the emerging world. That kind of has discovered that I want a place that isn't necessarily Western, but also works as well as the West. And Dubai is at the forefront of that.
One of the most interesting deals I saw when it came to the UAE investing in Africa this year was a very small one, and it was the Abraj Group, the big private equity company based here, and they bought 100% of Java House Group, which is a leading coffee company.
This is an issue very dear to my heart, because actually Java Coffee is the coffee that I drink, and it's the one that I get delivered from Kenya, so I think Abraj is going to get that coffee closer to me now.
Which is a good thing, and we expect these big government-driven deals. You talked about Emirates Airline, you talked about Dubai Ports, and they're great, they're flagship deals. But when you get in these small deals, buying a chain, it produces lovely coffee, it has a few coffee shops, it's not a massive deal, but this is an investment firm. They invest all over the globe, and they've said, you know what, we've got a rising middle class, they want to drink coffee, there's a good export of coffee here. That struck me as an interesting deal.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the African growing middle class, what do they want? They want better education, they want better healthcare, they're willing to pay for better infrastructure, and they also want to have a good cup of coffee. So I think, I've heard the guys in Abraj talk about how committed they are to investing in healthcare, for example, in Africa, it being a sector that's been underinvested.
I would have said to you, sort of up until last year, that Dubai and the UAE would have spearheaded the sort of the Gulf-Africa relationship. Now, given what's happening in Saudi Arabia, it's going to be boom time over the next few years there. Do you see Saudi right in that mix as sort of that Gulf-Africa relationship?
Absolutely. I think Saudi Arabia has a number of priorities that overlap with the UAE's, but also probably more expand just because of the sheer size of Saudi. So, for example, they're very, very invested in Ethiopia when it comes to food security.
Food security. This is their buy up land, farm there, and export the food across to Saudi.
Exactly. And also, I think the ambitions of Saudi Arabia are a little bit different from the UAE when it comes to manufacturing, for example, or when it comes to just the scale of the activities. But fortunately, as you may imagine, Africa is just big enough for everybody.
Which parts of Africa do you think are the most likely to be the best trading partners?
So I kind of think of two crescents in Africa. You have an eastern crescent or southeastern crescent, and then kind of a northwestern crescent. So Morocco has been doing very interesting work on kind of becoming the hub to the western francophones all the way down to Senegal. And so in that way, Rabat has been a very interesting kind of gateway. And then on the other hand, you have Nairobi, which has been a traditional kind of entry point for non-Africans into Africa, and they've also positioned themselves in that way. So I think these slightly smaller countries are going to be better at that. But if you look at countries like Ethiopia or Egypt or Nigeria, they're just bigger countries, and then there's so much going on inside, it's just a very loud party. So you need those smaller countries to kind of like set the stage for entry points.
We've certainly heard a lot of positivity about Rwanda, for instance, over the last few months.
We're talking about investing in Africa. Delighted that our guest has stayed with us. He is Michel Al-Ghagawi, the Emirati writer and co-founder of the Washington and Abu Dhabi-based think tank Emerge 85. Michel, thanks for staying with us this morning. Let's continue looking at Africa. Your report from Emerge 85 has been released recently. It's called Bridging the Red Sea: How to Build an Africa-GCC Partnership. We were talking about the strength of ties, the UAE, the second biggest investor in Africa after China. Lots of SMSs coming in. I'm going to throw some of these at you, if I may, please. A couple of people have written in about the investment in Guinea by Emirates Global Aluminium, or aluminum, in a bauxite mine there. They've asked for your thoughts on that development, Michel.
Well, I think the ambition of the Emirates Global Aluminium business, which fundamentally is the birthchild of IMAL, which was a joint venture between Mubadala and Dubal, the Dubai aluminium company, is to build a globally integrated aluminium company from extraction of resources all the way to distribution of these finished goods, most probably in Asia. And so I think that resource is just an extraction and an example of the kind of breadth of that effort.
We've had a text in which somebody's put their thumb really on the heart of all relationships with Africa through the scramble of Africa, the colonization of Africa. And that is that sort of global powers coming in, taking the sort of resources out of Africa, you take it to your home country, you manufacture it into something else, and then send it back. And the demand for that product makes everything so expensive in the local market. Somebody has said, the problem with this is it doesn't seem to help the locals in Africa. You mentioned coffee. In Kenya, coffee is expensive for locals because everyone's exporting it to the Gulf and elsewhere around the world. Mm-hmm. It's been the big conundrum with investment into Africa.
Well, you're right, but I think the most interesting thing that's been happening in Africa is the inter-African trade. So, for example, I think this is going to continue unless Africans start investing in Africa itself. So you have the East African community of Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Burundi, Rwanda, hoping to form a single currency by 2024. And then you have South Africa and its immediate neighbors, plus several former French colonies in West Africa. Both are already have monetary unions. So I think there's a lot of that happening. And then there's also technology hubs that are developing in Africa.
I follow you on Twitter. One of the stories that you've been covering lately is Saudi Arabia. And in fact, the title of your report is Bridging the Red Sea, How to Build an Africa GCC Partnership. It's not just about the UAE. And Saudi Arabia is a big story. You were very active on Twitter a couple of weeks ago when Saudi Arabia lifted the driving ban, the ban on women driving, mm-hmm. which is one pillar of a multifaceted reform program that I know you've been looking at closely. How significant do you see the changes in Saudi Arabia at the moment?
I think they're extremely significant. I think the ambitions of King Salman and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman are extremely high. There is a recognition that there isn't a lot of time to kind of dally over or dither. There is a sense also that this reform is not only economic, it's also social. And that those two things go hand in hand. And so whether it's creating jobs, whether it's diversifying the economy, whether it's moving away from reliance on oil, but equally getting women to work, getting women to drive, which is, I think, symbolic considering, you know, Uber and Karim and driverless cars coming one day. But I think it's the act of that bringing women to the same level of men, not just because we want to be progressive, but also because it makes sense.
It's long been said of Africa that when you get elected to office, it's an opportunity for graft. I mean, there have been high levels of corruption. They've blighted many a relationship between other countries outside Africa and African countries. Transparency International, their Corruption Perceptions Index, ranks Botswana at 35 on the list, Rwanda at 50, Namibia at 53, with one being the highest. Most African countries, though, are sort of down in the hundreds. And we as a region here in the Gulf, we're virtually squeaky clean in terms of corruption. I mean, it creates a mismatch between the way we do business here and expect business to be conducted. How big an issue is that divide, do you think?
I don't think it's that big of an issue because fundamentally, the UAE, for example, has been host to many different cultures that have come either to work or to invest. And it's been able to kind of, I think, show these different cultures that, you know, we sort of the Browns of this world or sort of the non-Westerns of this world can actually, you know, run cities well, can build decent countries and decent companies and things like that. And I think that's been very, very, very contagious in a very, very positive way.
Do you think anyone making an investment to Africa has to watch it a little bit more closely perhaps than investments into other parts of the world?
I don't think so. I think this can happen in a lot of different places. I do think there's something specific about Africa, but equally I would say, I don't know, if I was investing in Vietnam, I wouldn't necessarily feel a little bit safer than investing in Africa. I mean, we've seen people have a tough time in Southeast Asia and a whole bunch of places. Latin America, it's tough.
Very quickly on this, I know Malcolm has a slight concern, not a major concern, that the rise and the emergence of Saudi Arabia may not be entirely good for the UAE and Dubai. Lots of international companies are hubbed out of Dubai, and that's great. But if suddenly Riyadh becomes a viable option for, I don't know, IBM and the like to have their regional headquarters, we may suffer a little bit. What's your thought on that?
So I like to always say that Dubai is a Singapore of many Asias.
So in what sense? What do you mean?
So think about that, right? So Singapore fundamentally services a very specific market, a very specific geography. Who does Dubai service? Does it service Khalijis? Does it service Arabs? Does it service Central Asians? Does it service a subcontinent? Does it service East Africa? Does it service West Africa? I think all of the above. So fundamentally, what I'm trying to say is that if Saudi Arabia is going to grow, there'll be more people who want to go to Saudi Arabia. And where will they pit stop before they go into Saudi Arabia? Where will they pit stop if Iran ever opened up and it were reconciled with the global order? Where will those meetings happen? So I think when you're a hub city, having a lot of spokes that are growing, that are bigger than you, is actually good for you.
Michelle, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been fascinating talking to you. Come back soon. We could have spoken for hours. We really could. Lots of SMSs coming in. But for now, Michelle Al-Ghagawi, the Emirati writer and co-founder of the think tank Emerge 85. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.